we meet the other candidate in the Florida House District 96 race, Kristen Jacobs. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Jacobs is the incumbent, and we're going to ask her about sea level rise, gun legislation, and agriculture, and some of your questions as well. Plus, the Palm Beach Sheriff's Office is now going through hundreds of rape kits, but how many of those are leading to arrests? We hear from the reporter behind the investigation and from the department working directly with victims. And it's Shark Week, but really, what do we know about the undersea predator? Where do they hang out in South Florida? And how are we impacting their survival? Researchers at the University of Miami are exploring these topics. They're also tracking where sharks go. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Representative Kristen Jacobs has taken a unique approach to reducing sea level rise and mitigating the effects of climate change. She's one of the pioneers behind the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Compact, an agreement between Monroe, Broward, Miami-Dade, and Palm Beach counties, this to have the same data standards for sea level rise projections and follow guidelines that reduce our carbon footprint. Jacobs is currently running for re-election in District 96, which covers a large swath of Broward County, including Parkland. She helped in the passage of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Act and has made school safety a top campaign priority. Now, earlier we spoke with Democratic challenger Saima Farooqui, who, if elected, would become the first Muslim in Florida's state house. Now, just a reminder, next Monday is the deadline for you to register to vote in this year's primaries. Now, we started our conversation with Representative Jacobs by asking why she's running for this office.
Because I love what I'm doing. It's such an honor to be there. I know that sounds kind of corny, but when I first ran for the House, I wasn't sure where I was going to land or what I would be able to contribute because it's so partisan and it's so top-down driven. And in my freshman year, I really struggled with that, the first year in particular. But by the second and then by the third session, I started to figure out how to navigate the system. I reached out for mentors on both sides of the aisle and in both chambers. And in so doing, I learned a lot about how to move bills. And so my bills moved in this last year. It was really exciting to see them get voted on and pass on the floor and see the governor sign them. There's a lot more work that I'd love to do. And hopefully I get this next year, this next session, and then the one after that. And then, I don't know, they say we make plans and God laughs. So I have no idea what's beyond this. But I know the thing in front of me, the thing I'm most passionate and want to do, is go back to the House and do good things for Broward.
And what's one bill in particular that you're most proud of that did pass?
Well, most recently, it was the House Bill 53, which set up a conservation zone that went from the Dry Tortugas all the way to St. Lucie Inlet across four counties and set up a conservation area that's similar to the National Marine Sanctuary of the Keys and just basically extended it north. The reason for this bill, I introduced it last year as well, and it didn't pass last year. But the second part of it, which was the $1 million for funding and monitoring, did pass last year and was also included into DEP's budget going forward this year. So I don't have to keep doing a member project to continue the funding. So the bill basically takes a look at our coral reef system, which is in decline. We've lost 21 of 35 species in just over 2 years, and we don't know why they're dying. One of them was 330 years old, and before the universities could get out there and take samples so they could take it back to their labs and actually grow those corals and try to implant or plant them back later, it died that quickly.
What do you see as the more urgent issues for your district?
Sea level rise right now is a huge issue and has been. It's something I've worked on for almost all of my career. And it's a real challenge for not just people think of sea level rise as an issue for the coast, but I can show you photographs of flooding 35 miles inland in Palm Beach County. We know what happened in Jacksonville and throughout the state with Hurricane Irma. And, I mean, we've got almost a billion claims that went in from one storm. So we know that we're not necessarily going to be getting more storms, but the ones that we have will come in greater severity. Everything from our potable water to our infrastructure is at risk. And for those governments that wake up and start addressing the issue, they are going to have that advantage of those that have it. And so some of that work, a lot of that work needs to happen on the state side. It's not, I jokingly say that the real grown-ups in the room are cities and counties that are tackling this issue out of a pragmatic sense of what needs to get done and looking long enough into the future to set their dollars and their budgets aside to address it. And the state is varying steps, fits and starts of what they're doing.
All right, let's jump into that as one of the big topics. And of course, is the issue of climate change, sea level rise. Explain to us how the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Compact got started. This is a big one for you.
It is. It's my baby. It started with a visit to Washington. There were a variety of people from county commissioners back when I was a county commissioner. And we were visiting from all over the country, and they grouped us by our region. So I was moving through congressional offices with county commissioners from Miami-Dade, Monroe, and Palm Beach. And at the end of the day, we could each tell each other stories about what was happening with climate change in our communities and in our counties. And I thought, you know, we ought to do this for real. Couldn't we come together and do something formally? So it took a whole year to get the counties to pass the compact. There were points where I didn't think it was going to happen. One county changes the words and you have to re-agenda it and re-adopt it. And poor Monroe County had to do that three times. Palm Beach had to adopt it twice because the two big ones in the room, Broward and Miami-Dade, kept making changes. But ultimately, we passed it. It's now been 10 years. And as a result of this compact, the four counties are moving forward as a region. We started with 110 specific recommendations that were then turned into the Regional Climate Action Plan, which has just recently been readopted, understanding that there are new elected officials that weren't here when the compact first started. And it's always kind of scary to re-agenda something, but you wanted to make sure that everyone's still in. And so it passed unanimously across the four counties.
How does that compact function exactly? I mean, these are not laws. These are just ideas that counties and cities should kind of all be on the same page with, right?
That's what's so beautiful about it, is it isn't law. No one was forced to do anything. And in my opinion, when you come together voluntarily out of a sense of shared interest and concern about the same challenge, and you start to look at what you can do and you do it together, that will last much, much longer than when you make it as a mandate. So the four counties adopted all of the same recommendations, but as far as implementing it, and over 80% of the regional action plan has been put into implementation. So it's not just a book of words, it's actually in place.
And so these are just, again, it's not a law, it's not anything that's required. So are there teeth, though? Does it have teeth to really enforce anything or to bring on change?
It does, because the counties individually and the cities under them, there's 109 cities, took the recommendations and implemented them as their budgets and their own political leadership wanted to see fit. So you have, for example, the region agreed on a unified sea level projection that took a year just to develop that, to bring all of the players, including FEDA and state, together. And then we all started planning around that horizon. So we're doing it each in our own way, but we're doing it within the confines of this plan. It doesn't mean that you have to take every piece of that plan. And there's no punishment if you don't do it. The best thing is that over 10 years, everyone, every city and county has been moving in the same direction.
Help us understand what's going on in Tallahassee. So what we've seen over the last few years is that there is a lot of pushback on the idea of climate change. There were, you know, stories that the governor doesn't even want to say the word. Granted, he has now started saying the word in his campaign for U.S. Senate. But what's going on in Tallahassee? How do they see this issue any differently than what we're going through and what we think down here?
It's interesting that the state is more removed from it than the cities and the counties are. And I think probably that has a lot to do with the fact that legislators come from all over the state. They come from various backgrounds where they may not have the expertise, and they're only there during session or special sessions, which can, in my first year, for example, session went for 16 months. I was away from home. But generally, you're not there that long. And so what's happening in Tallahassee is we hear this all the time, the governor won't say climate change. But the truth is, he has passed during his time as a governor four bills that were related to climate change. One of them was my bill. And this bill took a kind of a page out of where we all started as counties in our compact, which was first get your own backyard in order. Let's look and see what the state agencies are doing. They're not talking to one another. They're all kind of isolated in their silos. So the bill required them to come together at least four times a year, which they actually now do more often than the mandated four times, but to come up and come out of their silos and plan together so the agencies are talking to one another. So that's been incredibly helpful. The governor signed that bill, and ironically, he signed that bill on climate change the same day that President Trump walked away from the Paris Accord. So we often say we can't say climate change in the state. The Secretary Ballenstein, who's the head of DEP, the Department of Environmental Protection, he has faced that agency from inward to kind of outward looking and are giving resources for this issue.
Do you get the sense that other lawmakers in the state, regardless of party, that they're on board with the issue and that this is a problem, not just for South Florida, this is a problem for the entire state, the country? Do you think they get it?
I think there are those that do, and there are some that don't. Luckily, I am on a series of committees as ranking member where these bills, anything that deals with the environment, water, agriculture, comes in. I'm on the first committee, and I'm on the second and the third committee until that bill gets to the floor. So I'm blessed to be in that role. I'm really thankful the speaker put me there, and hopeful that that's right where I end up again, to be able to influence those bills. And as you work through those committees, you see all of the folks I serve with in that path. They are engaged in this issue. They are paying attention.
You're listening to a previous conversation we had with Democratic Representative Kristen Jacobs, who represents Florida's District 96. That district includes Parkland, Coral Springs, Coconut Creek, and Margate. Jacobs is running against Asima Faruqi of Coconut Creek. Jacobs also runs the nonprofit Resiliency Florida and has made climate change, school safety, and agriculture among her priorities in the legislature. Let's return to that conversation.
Let's move to the issue of school safety, gun laws. District encompasses Parkland, of course, the site of the deadly shooting back in February. Talk about the conversations that you had with parents and teachers after that tragedy.
You know, it was such an emotional time that it's left its mark on so many people. The legislature was not exempt from that. And so we did pass the gun safety bill. It's the first gun control bill that's been passed in this state in 20 years. It was, at the end of the day, it was a bipartisan effort. There were people on either side of that issue that felt very strongly that their party needed to control their vote. And there were a whole bunch of us that knew you could not come home with nothing. We had to be able to come out of this tragedy with something good. The 17 families who lost their children all were unified in asking for that bill to pass. And so
the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Act.
Yes, okay. Exactly. And so it's made changes, but we need a lot more time to understand exactly, you know, how all these dollars are going to be spent.
And some of your Democratic counterparts boycotted the legislation. They didn't think it went far enough. But you, some other Democrats, felt this is better than nothing? I mean, why did you go for it?
I think it's essential that we don't take a my way or the highway approach. If we had asked for everything on one side of the aisle, what all Democrats wanted, it would never have moved through the House. It's interesting when you consider there's 120 members of the House and only 41 of them are Democrats. So we can stomp our feet and yell and scream all we want, but nothing's moving without the blessing of leadership. So, and if you look across this country, you see over and over that people have forgotten how to govern. They've gotten so locked into their one position that they will not budge. And I felt, and I know a lot of my colleagues felt, this issue is too important to play that game. We simply must be able to come home with something.
It was, people will say that gun legislation wasn't even on the radar until the Parkland shooting. And then we saw a governor go against the NRA, which the NRA is now suing because of this law. Do you think that carries over into the next session, there'll be another discussion about school safety and guns, or really, was it just because of the pressure that you had from the students and families who have been shoving this in people's faces?
I do believe we're going to have some sort of discussion about the bill and going forward. We put $400 million towards solving some of the problems. To the degree to which leadership feels that those dollars are well spent and some that want to see it spent in another direction, I think there is going to be some conversation. I don't know whether a bill will be introduced to take it to the next step. I do think it was kind of a once-in-a-lifetime bill that passed. The circumstances were just right. The activism, the families, the kids, oh my goodness, the kids, they were a huge factor in moving it forward. I don't think that this issue is going away. The students aren't going to let it go away. All of us that were affected aren't going to let it go away.
Let me move over to another topic. Lots to cover here. You were formerly the Democratic ranking member of the Agriculture and Natural Resources Subcommittee. The algae blooms have already devastating the state on both coasts and consistently a problem year to year. What's been wrong in our approach? I know that the Army Corps of Engineer plays a big role in this, but what's wrong in our approach here? How do we solve this problem?
Septic tanks. If you look at DEP and the Department of Health, DEP on the Indian River Lagoon has estimated there's about 400,000 septic tanks, 50% of which are over 30 years old. They're basically flushing toilets straight into the water bodies. The storm water is running off straight untreated into the water bodies. 70% of the pollution in those areas is coming from us. We don't want to look at it that way, though. We don't want to look at our pockets, the cost to go from septic to sewer. The problems that happen when excess water falls and runs through the lake and comes out the backside. There's a big argument to send it south. We can't continue to send too much water south because we'll drown out the ecosystem of the Everglades. What we need to do is finish the projects in the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, which has been in place for well over 20 years, and most of that plan has never been implemented. The Tamiami Trail has 1 mile of it constructed that is to raise it up so the water can flow. Another mile is under construction now, but there's a total of 10 miles that have still, you know, that's sitting there and unfunded. There are lots of other projects in the southern part of the SERP plan that are also not funded. So I think sometimes people want to point the finger to one agricultural industry and say it's them, that's the problem, we need to solve that.
Well, whether it's one agricultural industry or they just want to say it's ag. Ag plays a big part, but, I mean, what about that argument?
You know, so if you think about when your septic tank gets pumped out, where does that go? Most people think it goes to a wastewater treatment plant and gets treated somehow. But up there, the septic tanks, they get pumped out, they get what's called dewatered, they pull some of the water out, and then it is spread over agriculture as fertilizer. These are processes that need to stop. Ag is a part of the problem, but more importantly, we are a part of the problem. It is a broad problem that needs to be addressed. If you consider how all of the inputs that are coming from the Orlando or central part of the state, the water that's rolling into the lake is coming in at about 400 parts per billion phosphorus. It's coming out of the lake across different farms because they're taxed and because they have mandatory best management practices. On the south side of the lake, you will see that those waters are being tested at anywhere from 8 and 10 and 12 parts per billion. What's coming in is coming in from ag that has they don't have mandatory best management practices. It's voluntary. So I think there's a lot of ways in which some of the bills we've passed are chipping away at it. I resist and actually I get frustrated by this issue being made into a partisan one. This is not about partisan politics. This is about if you really love our state, and I do, you know that there are broader problems and broader solutions out there than just the one.
Based on reporting by the Miami Herald and the nonprofit VoteSmart, you've received financial contributions from companies in ag. Can you confirm that you have independence from these industries that are supporting your campaign?
Oh, absolutely. I've had contributions from all kinds of industries. Ag is a part of my contributions, but if you add up all of the contributions to my campaign, they're a very small amount. At the end of the day, unless the public wants to fund campaigns, and they don't, we have to raise money. That's a part of the process. It's a reality of running for office. And so, you know, I suppose you could go around saying, well, I won't take money from this one or I won't take money from that one. They're not buying anything with their money. That's part of the process, the political process.
All right. Looking at this upcoming election, there is a talk of a blue wave. But let's say that the House and Senate stay in Republican control. Let's say you have a Republican governor. Now, you did talk a little bit about reaching out to the other side for mentorship even. But how do you get things done when you have that sort of control by one party?
I've managed to get things done because I work across the aisle. If you think that standing at a podium and throwing political bombs and then go to the chair of a committee and ask him to hear your bill or ask the speaker to let your bill move forward, that's probably not going to work out too well for you. So it's an issue of respect for me. If you sit down with someone and you understand and you talk to them about what their issues are, you're not necessarily going to change your point of view, but you'll better understand theirs, that you understand that moving legislation forward isn't something you do by yourself. You can go yell and stomp your foot all you want, but unless you figured out how to work with one another, how to be respectful and civil, you're just simply not going to move anything forward. And honestly, to go to Tallahassee and be away from my family and my community as much as I have and go up there and not be able to accomplish anything but be partisan, be a partisan hack, I find that very unacceptable. I think we must figure out how to get along, how to govern. It's what people want from us. They don't want us to go up there and just rattle our partisan saber. They expect us to come home with something getting done.
That goes to something else that's interesting, is that you have to spend a certain amount of time in Tallahassee, but how do you balance the two? And, you know, what do you say to folks who say you're not here enough? You're not in your district enough. I mean, where's the balance?
You know, I find that an interesting comment because I am a state legislator. I'm not a county or city legislator. I also am a Democrat from Broward County. If I want to get things done, I have to understand it's not just working with leadership and committee chairs and so forth. It's the agencies themselves. Remember, agency heads are appointed by the governor. And given that you have Republican control right now, the agency heads don't listen to me. They listen to their legislators. To their leadership, unless, of course, you go and spend time with them, which is what I have done. I've spent time going to other parts of the state to meet my fellow legislators where they are. I have spent time with the different agencies, transportation and environmental protection are my chief ones. But there are other issues that are going on. If you think that you're going to be able to be a state legislator and stay home to do it, then you probably shouldn't be running for the state legislature. You're going to spend, I have spent a lot of time up there. It's a balancing act because it's 7 hours to drive up there. There's no quick way to fly either. And so it is a real sacrifice, the amount of time that you do spend away from your family and your kids and friends. But I think it comes with the territory. You just know if you're running for the Florida House, you're going to be away from home. And it's just the way it works.
We did get some questions from some of our listeners. Here's one in particular that they wanted to know what particular legislation you've worked on, or in what ways have you tried to fight the issue of discrimination in protecting minority groups like the LGBTQ community?
You know, when I look at a lot of the issues that we've taken on, we haven't had bills that have come through that have been advanced in that area. And because I sit in sort of a little silo of environment from the beginning, I'm ranking member on two of my four committees, and none of those are the issues that are dealing with minority issues. So I haven't really had much experience in that arena, as you won't. And as you get into the House, you get siloed into these different categories of committee, and that's where you spend your time.
So I'll finish with this. For you, what do you see as the most important thing for you if you get reelected? What's that pressing issue that you really want to push most for?
The issue I think facing our state right now is the issue of water. Whether you're losing your wells to saltwater intrusion, or you have issues of flooding, or you have issues associated with rising insurance costs because of flooding and the way the markets look at our state and risk-based pricing, all of that is about to change. Water is a huge issue for our state, and I think it's really important that that a person who knows these issues is up there pushing for change, and that's what I'll be doing.
And again, that was Democratic Representative Kristen Jacobs of Florida's 96th District. An editorial note, we incorrectly stated in our conversation with Saima Faruqi, her opponent, that Pompano Beach is part of District 96. It is part of District 93. So our apologies on that. A reminder that this Monday is the deadline to register to vote in the upcoming primaries. Florida is a unique state. Remember, you have to be part of one of the parties if you want to vote in a primary election. All right, still to come, we're going to take a look at the story of Palm Beach County, where the sheriff's now working to process rape kits. But have any arrests been made? That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, a new investigation from the Palm Beach Post found that a $1 million program to test nearly 1,000 rape kits in Palm Beach County hasn't led to a single arrest. The initiative was started in 2016 by the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office as law enforcement agencies across the country were pushing through a backlog of untested rape kits. The Sheriff's Office argues they haven't finished through all of the kits and they are close to making arrests in a few cases. The invasive procedure of rape kits, the potential for re-traumatizing victims, and the complications of prosecuting rape suspects makes the cases all that much more complicated. Nicole Bishop is the director of Victim and Justice Services in Palm Beach County, which works directly with both sexual assault victims and with law enforcement. And also, Daphne Durrett is one of the reporters behind the Palm Beach Post investigation. Both of them are joining us now from the studios of WXEL in Boynton Beach. Nicole, Daphne, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Daphne, let me start with you. Help us understand this $1 million program started by the Sheriff's Department. I mean, what was the goal of the program and how did it launch?
Well, the program launched as there was a national push for ending a backlog in rape kit testing. And before laws changed in 2016 requiring fast testing of rape kits, the Palm Beach County Sheriff, Rick Bradshaw, announced that he wanted to put some money aside to start clearing the backlog of untested rape kits in Palm Beach County. And so that's what they did. And it's been more than 2 years since they've started this initiative. They do have several hundreds of rape kits to be tested still. At this point, though, they haven't made any arrests, although they told us that they are close to possibly making arrests in a few cases.
And you reviewed thousands of pages of documents detailing the program. Of the rape kits tested, do we know how many developed potential suspects at least?
Well, of the rape kits tested, there was only a portion of them that had even usable DNA evidence, meaning DNA evidence that could be tested to see if there were any matches. And they found 140 hits to an online a crime database. But of those 140, there were about 80 that produced new leads, meaning there were cases where the person previously didn't know who had raped her or what, those sort of details, and that the testing identified a new suspect.
You reported about a woman in Belgrade who was raped on Thanksgiving 6 years ago, where a suspect was discovered. Just give us a little more context into that case.
Yeah, in that case, there was a woman, I believe you're talking about the woman who was outside a market and was picked up by someone who offered her a ride home. And
yes.
And the gentleman just introduced himself by his first name. He had a friend in the car, brought her through a drive-through, took the friend home, and instead of taking her home, took her to a secluded area and raped her. And what we found was interesting about that case is that police found the DNA match to the suspect in the case, Isaac Johnson, just around the same time that he was accused in a subsequent rape of a woman who was in a wheelchair, and he had promised to take her back to his apartment for a shower, I guess, because she was homeless, and ended up according to her, tossing her from the wheelchair and raping her.
And so, I mean, in a case like that, where did it end up? How did it end up? Or where are we in this case?
Well, in this particular case, and this is something that we found with a lot of these cases, in this particular case, with Isaac Johnson, the state attorney's office ended up dropping the charges against Isaac Johnson. Now, what happens in a lot of these cases with sexual assault is what we found is that the cases hinge on whether or not a victim will cooperate with the prosecution. So basically, if a victim, for whatever reason, decides later that he or she doesn't want to pursue a prosecution, then prosecutors have no way to get a conviction.
Nicole, your department works directly with sexual assault victims and acts as an intermediary between victims and law enforcement. I mean, what are the steps that are taken by the sexual assault response team in the minutes, the hours after a rape victim comes forward?
So the process that's set up is that we have a violent crimes hotline, and Palm Beach County Victim Services is the carrier of the rape kit. So when law enforcement or a victim or a hospital contacts the hotline, an advocate is dispatched to either a local hospital or our rape exam facility at Wellington Regional Medical Center called the Butterfly House. And they also activate the sexual assault nurse examiner. So the SANE nurse, the advocate, shows up on site and they speak with the victim and speak with law enforcement and then move forward, either commencing an investigation or, if the victim chooses not to report, perhaps just doing the sexual battery kit.
And Nicole, I apologize because you're in another studio, so I'm not there with you. If you could move forward a little bit more to the microphone
sorry about
so I can
that.
Hear. No, it's
yes.
Okay. So how is your personnel trained to work with people in this very emotional, this vulnerable state following this horrible trauma?
So all of our advocates are trained through the advocacy core training that's offered through Florida Council Against Sexual Violence. And most of them have backgrounds in either psychology or social work. So they come to the table with some training that they've had, and then they also get additional training that focuses specifically on working with victims of sexual assault.
And can you tell me about also with law enforcement, you know, as much as you can, how they're trained in approaching someone who, again, has just gone through this trauma, the sort of things they're supposed to ask, the information they're supposed to get. Can you tell us about how they're supposed to handle that?
Well, I can't really speak specifically to what law enforcement is supposed to do because that's not my area of expertise. But I do know that it's very beneficial if they've been trained in interviewing victims who've experienced trauma. And some of those types of things, you know, in interviewing those types of victims are listening to them tell their story and how they recant the story. Because sometimes, for example, a victim of trauma might, their story might be all over the place. So they might not tell things in a sequential fashion, which leads some law enforcement officers to not believe them. So the more training that they have on how trauma affects the brain, the better.
I'm talking with Nicole Bishop, Director of Victim and Justice Services for Palm Beach County. Also, Daphne Durrett, reporter with the Palm Beach Post that covers criminal courts. A recent investigation from the Palm Beach Post found of the 994 rape kits examined in Palm Beach County since 2016, no arrests have been made yet. Daphne, you touched on something just a second ago. It's difficult to make arrests once the rape kit determines a potential suspect. You reviewed a case of a woman who wanted her case processed when the DNA matched a suspect in Georgia, but there was an issue with travel in that case. What was the deal?
Yes, this was a case of a woman who was raped and went through the process of getting a rape kit, and it was at least a decade ago. And when the detective contacted her and said, "Hey, we found a DNA match to the man who you said raped you," she agreed to cooperate with the prosecution of the case. And the next step was then to show her a photo lineup to see if she would pick the suspect out of a lineup. Well, She lives in Georgia, about an 8-hour drive from Palm Beach County. And what we saw from the report is that no one from the sheriff's office went to see her to show her the photo lineup. But the agency asked sheriff's deputies in Georgia to show her the photo lineup. And they initially agreed, but then called back and said that they couldn't do it because they couldn't afford the cost of sending an investigator to come and testify at the trial, should there be one. And so the detective in that case, according to the records that we saw, called or communicated with the victim and asked if she could come back to Palm Beach County and look at the photo lineup there. And she told them that she would call them back. They followed up again a couple of months later, and by then the woman's mother said that she had changed her mind and didn't want to prosecute anymore.
And so, this is this runaround to just try to get somebody to speak up on this issue. And it goes back to what you said before. Sometimes people just give up. I mean, how often does that happen? How often do people just say, nope, I don't want to deal with this anymore? Thus, there's no more, prosecution or no more effort in this case.
Well, we found several cases where that did happen for a variety of reasons. There were also cases that we found that we think, based on the people that we talked to, was a signal to larger views on what we would call rape culture in the United States. And in one particular case that we found, this was the case in Belgrade that we discussed earlier. The detective in the case that initially interviewed the victim in that case noted that her clothes didn't appear to be wrinkled. I think either he or someone at the hospital asked whether she'd screamed during the rape. And what we found by the people that we've talked to is that these kinds of questions, or these kinds of, whether it's deliberate or not, this sort of questioning of victims sometimes has a chilling effect on them and leads them to not want to cooperate with the prosecution because they don't feel like anyone believes them.
Nicole, real quickly, same kind of question to you, really, is what would make a victim avoid pressing charges or pushing forward if you have evidence?
I mean, there's so many things that would make a victim not choose to move forward. And I think I'm just reiterating what Daphne said, is that fear of not being believed is one of the biggest reasons. And when law enforcement asks questions in a way that makes the victim feel like they're not believed, then they don't want to go forward because they feel as though no one will believe them. If, you know, the law enforcement officer doesn't, then will the jury, will the judge? So that's one of the things that stops them from moving forward. Sometimes there's alcohol involved, and maybe they have overindulged and they don't remember exactly all of the details of the case. So that makes them not want to go forward.
Nicole, real quickly, for victims of sexual assault, how can they get in contact with your department for any help?
We have a 24-hour helpline. It is 561-833-7273. And we are available 24 hours a day for all victims of sexual assault, whether it happened yesterday or 10 years ago. We hope that folks will reach out to us.
We'll make sure we get that information out there on the web as well. Again, Nicole Bishop, Director of Victim and Justice Services for Palm Beach County. Also, Daphne Durrett, reporter with the Palm Beach Post, on this story again about rape kits in Palm Beach County. And what, no arrests yet made on so many rape kits that are already being processed. Daphne, Nicole, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, lighten things up a little bit. It is Shark Week. We're going to talk with a professor, a researcher from the University of Miami on some of the research they're doing, what they're learning about sharks right here off the coast of Miami. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, this week marks the 30th anniversary of Shark Week. The cable series under the Discovery Channel has given sharks center stage for many years, and of course, it helped educate the public. In South Florida, there are sharks everywhere. Blue sharks, tiger sharks, hammerhead sharks. By the way, did you know that some of them like to hang out around Brickell and Biscayne Bay? And, well, they're really kind of everywhere. And sharks face a ton of threats. We know about these, overfishing, but that's not the only problem. Sharks are being affected by pollution, human waste, development. Well, here to teach us more about the latest in shark research is Assistant Director, I accidentally called him Professor, for Shark Research, Stephen Kane at the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science. Stephen, great to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me and for the promotion.
All right, so on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being, you know, highly threatened, how much are sharks' existence really threatened?
Well, we know, you know, for certain that some studies put the, you know, that sharks are being extirpated at a rate of almost 100 million each year. Really, when we're looking at local issues, though, we know that there's a couple different species that are particularly threatened that we're interested, you know, closer to home here. And to really try to answer your question, we're just not sure yet. I mean, that's what the process is right now. We're trying to determine that.
Let's talk about the main threats for sharks right now, specifically what they're facing in South Florida. What would you say are a couple of the big ones?
Sure. So we're right at the beginning of this brand new project, which we call the Urban Shark Project. You know, we're sitting here next to Miami with this population of 2.6 million people, and we're trying to answer that question. You know, what's the implication of living in a highly urbanized environment where you've got freshwater input that's been somewhat degraded? You've got over the issues of overfishing. You've got a coastline that's been largely built, one of the most developed areas in the country, actually. And so we're really trying to determine how sharks are, you know, where are they in this environment? How are they using the bay? How are they moving in it? And then, you know, what are the implications for their immunological health?
We talked about, for example, that, and I had mentioned that they're hanging out in certain areas. I mean, Biscayne Bay, of course, but like around Brickell, around the marina, around, I mean, they're in a lot of different pockets around us. They're always right there with us.
You have to stay tuned on some of our future studies. I can't really divulge all the details just yet. But I can tell you that we do have equipment here in the bay, and actually just a stone's throw from the studio right here. I can tell you that we've tracked sharks right up to Perez Art Museum, right out in front of AAA American Airlines Arena, you know, in areas further south, including all the way to, you know, Turkey Point South nuclear facility. So we are currently watching where they're moving, and it's often a much closer than people imagine.
Now, you're watching where they're moving, but just real quickly, too, is you're trying to figure out how, I mean, what, water temperatures, the pollution in our water, and the fact that, you know, we have all this, I didn't realize this construction that we have here up along the water, that's also impacting them, too?
Right. So, you know, when we say something like urbanized ecosystem, what, in fact, does that mean? Well, I can tell you that, you know, the animals here in the water, they've got more light that's coming at them. They've got issues of boat traffic and more sound. And all these things are going to have unintended consequences in the marine environment. And so we're really trying to determine, you know, is that a factor in how these sharks, you know, go about their day here in Miami?
You guys are working on your tracking shark. You've been tracking sharks for years, actually. I mean, scientists have been tracking sharks for a long time. But you're out there, you're tagging them, you're tracking them by satellite. You want to see their migration patterns. You want to see where they're going. All right, so far, what have you learned?
Oh, well, that's a really great question. So we know, you know, satellite tags are really great when you slap them on the fin of a shark and you let them go, but, you know, really only tells part of the story, because every time the shark's fin breaks the surface, that's when we have that information. Every time the shark dips below the surface, we don't have access to that because the satellite can't report to the tag itself. So we know basically the minimum distance that these sharks are traveling, and we're really trying to connect the dots. What are they doing in between? Does that overlap with areas that are particularly vulnerable to human impact, to things like overfishing? And are those areas of overlap really important to sharks, whatever they happen to be doing, whether it's hunting and foraging or perhaps mating and bearing young?
We do, by the way, just want to mention that interactive map that shows where sharks are going and how we're tracking them. We do have that up on our social media, Twitter and Facebook, so you could check that out. But, I mean, you know, when you're looking at it, is there anything surprising? How much do we know about sharks? We've been 30 years now. Shark Week's been going on. But, I mean, we've been studying for a long time. How much do we really know and not know?
That's a really great question, you know, and for me personally, you know, I'm kind of a first generation Shark Week kid, so I grew up knowing about these types of technologies. In fact, you know, I was sort of watching and saying, man, I would love to be a part of something like that. And I'm asking that question now, being in the position that I am. And, you know, we've come a long way. That's great. And we tell the public, you know, we put these satellite tags on there so we can track the movements of sharks. And I think that, you know, often people say, well, is that enough? And the answer is, well, we're starting to see where sharks go. And now we're just starting to get to the point where we can say, why? You know, and we're really starting to, you know, look at local cues. We've got a project in Tiger Beach, for instance, which is just about 50 to 70 miles from here, where we're really studying a population of pregnant female tiger sharks. And we've just answered the question, what are they doing there? And it turns out that female tiger sharks are taking advantage of relatively shallow and warm waters to speed along gestation so that they then can move off in the early June and bear young somewhere on the eastern seaboard. And the next step is to say, well, where are they pupping and where are they going? And are those areas protected?
I'm talking with marine biologist Stephen Kane from the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science. Of course, as Shark Week continues on the Discovery Channel, we discuss the latest research into shark populations here in South Florida. I saw some amazing photos when you guys are tagging, but also researching sharks. It's bringing the shark up to the boat and some of the things that you guys are doing. Just real quickly, tell us about what, once you get a shark up to the boat, you've got a few minutes really to do a whole bunch of stuff. What are you trying to get?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll actually take it just a step back for a second. One of the things that's pretty brilliant about what we're able to accomplish is there's not a research trip that we actually undertake that we're not conducting outreach. So while we conduct groundbreaking research at the Rosenstiel School, we're also conducting outreach, and we're taking about 1,000 people on the water every year. So every time that we're on the boat and we're sampling nearshore species just a stone's throw from South Beach, we've also got a group of probably high school kids from the local area, and they're out there and they're actually helping us conduct that research. And we're conducting that research, like I said, with those students, and we're doing that whole work up within 5 minutes. We're securing the sharks. We're trying to do a very quick workup so that we can get them on their way. And we're collecting a variety of information,
You're collecting blood tissue samples.
Absolutely.
And then you're tagging them.
Absolutely.
What is that telling you?
Well, it's telling a lot.
Like the blood, for example.
For sure. So we've got about 15 different research projects. And you know what? I would encourage you to join us on a shark tagging trip so you can see it firsthand yourself. You got to join us. That invite is open.
All right. I'm going to keep a distance from sharks. I appreciate nature from a distance, but okay.
Sure.
I appreciate the invitation.
Absolutely. Well, so then I'll have to tell you is that we're working on probably about 15 different research projects. And what's really exciting is they're not just sitting here at the University of Miami. We work with collaborators internationally. A fin clip from a shark, for instance, can be taken to be part of a genetics study that we're working with the Field Museum in Chicago. We're working with researchers right here at home at the University of Miami to focus on shark immunology. And previously, the lab has partnered up even with the medical school here at the University of Miami. We found that chemicals and toxins, which have been, growing in shark populations, are maybe not great for people if they're deciding to eat those. Consume sharks.
And I had wondered about this. I mean, just briefly tell us, look, we pollute the water. I mean, we've done shows talking about the plastics we throw and the impacts on sea turtles, for example. But I wonder, also a lot of our medications we're flushing out there.
Exactly.
And our waste we're flushing out there. What do we know about the stuff that we're throwing into the ocean and how it's impacting sharks right now?
So, I can't speak to, what types of, pollutants have been, accelerating in the ocean. But I do know that, previous studies that we've done here at the lab have shown, for instance, that, sharks, because they're top predators, they're consuming everything below them, right? And so there's this concept of biomagnification. You're sort of accruing all of these toxins as you move up the food chain. And sharks, unfortunately, have high levels of mercury and a nasty bacteria called BMAA, which has been linked to neurological disorders. And obviously, the implications are pretty clear right there. We know that, shark finning is a globally a pretty terrible practice and involves...
Where they catch the shark, but they only cut off the fin because it's a delicacy in some countries.
Exactly.
And they throw the rest of the shark
exactly.
out.
Exactly. And so, we think that the lines are pretty clear. If maybe if you consume those, you might think twice about it.
Is overfishing an issue with sharks? Are we causing a lot of damage?
So absolutely. Overfishing is, far and away just the number one threat facing sharks globally. It becomes a real challenge because here at home, we benefit from state laws, and at the federal level, we have some protections. But then once you get outside the exclusive economic zone of any country, then it's what we call the tragedy of the commons. There's not a whole lot of oversight or enforcement.
I want your take on this as we finish up. Do you think we as humans are a threat to the sharks? Could we eliminate sharks? And I bring it up because I've spoken with another shark guy from Florida Atlantic University, Stephen Caggiura, and he always smiles at me when I ask him that question. He goes, no, they're going to outlive us. We're in trouble.
That's a really thought-provoking idea, and I think that's definitely food for thought there. I think they're in trouble, but I would have to agree with you. We are equally in trouble if we don't pay attention.
You think they outlive us?
They could outlive us.
They've been around a long, long time, a lot longer than
450 million years is a long time. We're new kids on the block by comparison.
Do you still watch Shark Week? Do you care?
You know, our lab's been featured in it 3 times, and I'd like to make a personal plug for everybody tonight to watch Tiger Shark Invasion, which airs on Discovery Channel at 10 p.m. Eastern. So the answer is, yeah, I'll be watching.
All right. Again, he is marine biologist Stephen Kane from the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science. Find us on social media, Facebook or Twitter, WLRNSundoc, because we've linked up to a lot of the cool stuff that they are doing in their research. It really is cool. Stephen, thanks so much, man.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Got to get you back in. Maybe I'll go out with you on the boat someday.
Oh, please do.
And that's the program for today. Thank you so much for listening. Coming up next week on Sundial, if you've been to South Florida beaches recently, you've seen the brown seaweed washed up on shore. It's called sargassum, and it's having a big impact on tourism and the ecosystem. Also, a communal trauma expert from the Sandy Hook shooting lends her expertise to victims of the Parkland shooting, and a one-woman show where she plays no less than 24 characters. We'll get her to perform a little bit of that here on the program as well. That's all coming up next week on the show. Remember, you can find us at WLRN.org or on Facebook, Twitter, at WLRN Sundial. We always love to hear from you. Let us know what you think of the program. And don't forget, if you missed the show or any parts of the show, check out the podcast. You can find it on so many podcast outlets out there. Go ahead and find us on iTunes. Just look up WLRN Sundial and subscribe. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.